Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, October 29th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we talk about the great outdoors and the wildlife close to you, maybe in your own backyard. We welcome back Jeremy Hurst, Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Also with us today is Sean Mahar, Interim Commissioner of the DEC, who helps to lead the agency's environmental protection and natural resource conservation efforts. You got a question about the great outdoors? Maybe there's a bear rummaging around in your backyard. Give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551 or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. 800-348-2551. Jeremy Hurst, Sean Mahar, and your wildlife questions coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're going outdoors today, so to speak, in our minds on the program with Jeremy Hurst. Jeremy is the Game Management Section Head for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, facilitating the research, outreach, and management planning for New York's big game, small game, and presumably middle game, fur-bearing wildlife. Previously, he coordinated New York's management programs for white-tailed deer, black bear, and moose management programs. Also with us today is Sean Mahar, a graduate of Siena. Sean is interim commissioner of the New York DEC, helping to lead the agency's environmental protection and natural resource conservation efforts. Before joining DEC, he was the director of government relations and communications for Audubon New York, where he led efforts to advance state and federal conservation policies and build support for wildlife conservation initiatives in the state, including climate change adaptation strategies. You got a question for these guys today? 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst, Sean Mahar, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us on.
You know, Jeremy, it occurs to me that most of the times when you bring a sidekick, they can make animal noises.
Oh, you're starting right off the bat.
I don't know. I mean, Mahar's kind of a big wig. Can you make any noises like animals?
Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo! That's a barred owl.
It's a wombat. Oh, it's a barred owl. Okay, yeah. Good for you. That was excellent. Hey, before we get going with the calls, you guys sent a contingent down to North Carolina, which was just brutalized by the hurricane. Sean, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was a very active summer across the country. We actually had crews go out to help wildfire response in Montana and some of the other states this summer. But really, the hurricane response was where Team DEC and really Team New York State really stepped up to help North Carolina. So we had a number of crews go down. Our first crew was a contingent of six forest rangers who were helping with swift water rescues and part of the initial emergency response. We're going to have some more of their stories come out. I know our team has put together some video packages on that you can see on our social media channels and really hear about what they were doing. And then we had another crew of six forest rangers go down as part of the state's incident management team. Yeah. And this is really to help the emergency response efforts play out. It was really the longest time that we had a crew out in the field. They were there for 3 weeks. And then we also had some communication experts go down, some fiscal management experts, and really just helping out as best as we could.
It was terrible devastation.
It was.
Glad you guys could help out. We have a wildfire risk. Jeremy, maybe you could tell me about what's going on with that throughout the state.
Well, the real issue is that we just haven't had that much rain, and so the conditions are pretty dry out there, and that sets the stage for wildfires, whether it be from an escape campfire or lightning strike or just somebody throwing a careless cigarette.
Yeah.
And so wildfire risk around the state, most heavily and most problematic in the Southern Hudson Valley.
Best practices for that. If you're a camper, how do you deal with that?
Well, ensure that the fire that you have your campsite is put out before you leave. Make sure you throw some water on it. For homeowners, maybe having a backyard campfire, just be careful. The same thing, put the fire out. And then for anyone else, be careful starting fires when it's windy. We want to make sure that the fire embers don't carry in the wind and then catch grass on fire.
What about backyard grills, charcoal grills? I mean, believe it or not, Sean, this is a conversation my wife and I have every time we grill. We'll go out, we'll test the wind. Oh, it looks like 5 to 6 miles an hour. I think we'll be okay. What's the sweet spot for if you're grilling out in the backyard? How high can the winds be, and can you still be safe with a charcoal grill?
That's a good question, but I think the real issue is what kind of meat you're putting on the grill.
Oh. Well,
from a fire danger, though, it's really what you do with the charcoal when you're done. Do you just take it out back and dump it, or you let it burn itself out? Let it burn itself out before you dump it.
Okay, couple things. The bear issue. We'll get into the bear issue. I saw a thing in the Times Union. We had a meeting, and I was thumbing through the Times Union beforehand, and apparently the school recess got canceled by a bear cavorting in the back of, I think, Gilderland, or was it Niskayuna? I don't know, but one of the local elementary schools. This is bear time, right? And what do we do to make sure the bears aren't in our backyards?
Bear time? I think bears are out there all the time.
Well, but if they're cavorting in an elementary school, that's
cavorting
kind of,
is an interesting word.
I think that was in the Times Union,
maybe
by the way.
Feeding. So bears are still active this time of year. In fact, they're going through a period of what's called hyperphagia, where they are basically gorging on whatever food they can find. We have abundant food resources right now. There are apples all over the place. And acorns are really abundant this year, particularly red oaks. And so those are just food sources that bears are going to consume. They're trying to put on as much weight as they can before they go into the den season. And so it's not uncommon to see bears where there are some food resources. And, of course, around our suburban areas, there's lots of garbage and lots of bird feeders that are still up and lots of food for bears. And so, in fact, my son's soccer game got canceled yesterday because of a bear that was seen near the school.
Oh,
so
see?
I can empathize with all the kids in East Greenbush.
And if it was up to you, would you say play on? With the soccer game?
I'd want to know more about the circumstances, but very likely I'd
really?
Play on.
Okay, fair enough. All right, last thing on my list here for now, and then you gave me a few more things. So the number's 800-348-2551. We're joined by Jeremy Hurst and Sean Mahar from the New York State DEC. We head outdoors today. Saw a thing came over to the newsroom, maybe it was during the fun drive, so I have no idea what day it was, but it was about chronic wasting disease, and I think Broome County and some other counties. What's the status? And, well, start with that.
Yeah, so this is an emerging issue that we're encountering. Chronic wasting disease isn't found in New York. Jeremy and his team have done a really good job of keeping chronic wasting disease out of New York. But we had a detection in a captive facility that is now being actively investigated.
What's a captive facility? That's one thing I wanted to know.
Yeah, so this is like a deer farm. There are deer farms in the state where farmers are growing deer for meat production for sale at farmers markets or different outlets that like venison. So there's a lot of monitoring that we do with a USDA and the Agriculture and Markets Department here in the state, and we had a detection pop up.
You know, it occurs to me from reading that press release that there, and Jeremy, help me understand the details here, but there really isn't data that says, it or is there, that it'll pass to humans, but that in the same paragraph it said, well, don't eat the venison.
Yeah, it does seem somewhat of a mixed message, but chronic wasting disease has been identified in North America since 1967 or something like that. And in that time, people have been consuming venison all over the country. In some places where there has been chronic wasting disease endemic, presumably some of those have been eating venison that was from sick deer. So there's no linkage of chronic wasting disease as a disease agent to human health concern at this point. Despite all that time frame and intense monitoring by Department of Health and CDC and so on. However, we always provide that caveat that it's not wise to eat meat from animals that are known to be sick, whether that's chronic wasting disease or pneumonia. We tell hunters and the public at large not to consume animals that are known to be sick. And so that same message applies for chronic wasting disease.
And so hunters will know if they see a deer that has chronic wasting disease, right?
Actually, probably not.
Really?
So that's one of the real challenges with chronic wasting disease is it's called a wasting disease, but the disease isn't really evident in symptomatic for the deer until about 2 years of incubation time. All that time, and this is why CWD is such a difficult disease to manage, deer can be infected for up to 2 years and be shedding the disease agent, the prion, making other deer infected, but not show symptoms until about 2 years after infection. And so at that point, after that 2 year period or the incubation period, then they might start to show emaciation and some neurological symptoms and they'll decline fairly quickly. But that's a pretty long incubation period of making everybody else infected. And so that's one of the reasons why we're so concerned about the disease.
Now, you guys probably can't answer this question, but if, let's just take it as a given for now that it doesn't pass to humans. If it went unchecked and the press release didn't go out and hunters weren't caring about it, would it wipe out all the deer?
No. but it will have some dramatic impacts on the population. And so let me go back and correct one thing you said earlier. You mentioned Broome County, which is in the southern part of
Region 6. I thought it was Broome.
So this particular instance is in Region 6, which is in the northwestern portion of the Adirondacks and part of central New York. And so so chronic wasting disease, one of the reasons we're really concerned is, like I said, it can spread without a whole lot of evidence.
Right.
Over time, it will increase in prevalence in the population if it's not managed effectively. And as more and more deer get infected, of course, the potential for that disease to spread even further increases to the point where you start seeing more and more deer die from this. And so deer are, you know, a treasured natural resource for us. People enjoy watching deer. People enjoy hunting deer. People enjoy consuming venison. All those things that we love about deer will be compromised if chronic wasting disease gets into our wild population and spreads wildly. And so we're concerned about that. You know, to put it in a human perspective, places, parts of Wisconsin, parts of Pennsylvania, parts of West Virginia where chronic wasting disease is really prevalent. It might be 50% of the adult bucks in some areas of Wisconsin have chronic wasting disease.
Wow.
That means on a particular farm where people are hunting, 50% of those deer that get shot, they can't consume, and they have to watch those deer in their properties suffer and waste away. And then they go through the effort and enjoyment of hunting and then not being able to consume the meat. And so there's just a whole cultural complication that comes about that and a lot of loss of resource.
We're joined today by Sean Mahar, who is interim commissioner of the New York State DEC, and Jeremy Hurst, who is the game management section head for the DEC. The number to call is 800-348-2551, and we will get to your calls and emails after the first break. Two more things. One, you brought it up, Sean. I did not know the DEC has a podcast.
We do.
And what's this business about sturgeon thunder? Explain.
Well, you should check out wherever you get your podcast, DEC Does What? And it was our opportunity to really, you know, try. Sorry to make you laugh.
DEC Does What?
Exactly.
Okay.
Because I find myself asking that question every day when someone comes in with something new that I didn't realize we had regulatory authority over or that we were undertaking.
Yeah.
So it was our way of really trying to shine a positive light on all the great people who are working for DEC and all the depth and breadth of stuff. So Sturgeon Thunder is one of my favorite episodes now, where we had Chris Bowser on, who many folks in the Hudson Valley may know Chris if you've ever done a canoe program or seen him on our Facebook Lives or Instagram Lives. He's one of our faces out there, and we went behind the scenes, but he brought to our attention that sturgeon make noise underwater.
No way.
Totally.
And can you imitate?
I won't spoil it, because
okay.
You really should listen to the podcast.
Sturgeon Thunder. If that isn't a film title, I don't know. All right, Zach the engineer, you stayed. You thought about leaving, but you stayed. Let's do a break. 800-348-2551. We'll talk about Bat Week. We'll answer some questions. We'll have a few laughs. Sean Mahar, Jeremy Hurst are here. We'll be back. Who are the Brain Police? That's Ed Palermo doing the music of Zappa here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Jeremy Hurst and Sean Mahar are here from the DEC, and it's Bat Week. Who knew? Well, what's up with the Bat Week?
Well, it's an annual week where we want to shine a light on, and a positive light on, the bat species that are in New York State and all the work that we're doing to conserve them. And it's a way of making people bat aware. You know, seeing a bat in your backyard is actually a good thing. These are so essential to the health of our environment overall. We've had things like white nose syndrome.
Yeah,
how's
that work?
How
is that, the white nose? I mean, is it getting worse or better?
Well, that's what we're monitoring for across the state. And part of Bat Week is making people aware that, especially this time of year, you shouldn't go in caves. You know, if you're looking to try and find bats, keep your distance, give them space, because you going in that cave can disrupt their roosting, but also potentially help spread disease. And that's something we want to try and combat so we can keep our bats healthy.
You know, it seems to me, well, we've seen several bats flying around this summer. And in fact, I think we saw one the other night. But is it the fact that there seems to be, and I don't have data to back it up, it seems to be less flying insects. Is that part of the reason I'm seeing less bats than I did when I was a kid?
No. Really, it's going to be a function of white nose syndrome.
Okay.
And so when white nose came into the state, it really dramatically, and I mean dramatically, impacted bat populations in the state. We're talking some of the species that are 95 to 99% reduced from their prior numbers.
Wow.
The only real bat species in the state that's doing well is the big brown bat. The others are all really suffering. And so you're seeing fewer bats, not because there's fewer insects, but because there's fewer bats.
Interesting. All right, we have a question about bats, and David in Saugerties has been waiting for 20 minutes. David, go ahead. You're on.
Well, you stole my thunder. I was going to ask about bats.
Go ahead. Do it anyway.
Yeah, all right. Well, I put up a bat house, a big one, about 24 inches by 36 inches, about 15 feet off the ground. Early last spring, in hopes to attract bats to control mosquitoes and other bugs on the property, so that we could enjoy our deck outside. And fortunately, there weren't that many bugs this season, which was surprising. But also, when in the past we normally would see, you know, a number of bats flying around at dusk, I saw one through the whole summer and into the fall so far. And so I guess you guys pretty much answered my question.
Yeah, why are you being repetitive, David? I already asked that question. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm kidding, man. So go ahead, guys, if you want to elucidate a little bit here.
Yeah, I'll let Jeremy go into the science more of it. But, David, I mean, first, thanks for putting up a bat house. I mean, this is really important. People can take everyday actions in their backyard to really help look at their backyards as actual habitat. And these bat houses can be a really important tool to help boost that population. You do need to give it some time. You know, the bats will have to find the house that you put up. And eventually, over time, you'll probably start seeing them roost there, hopefully.
Yeah, and Sean mentioned that one of the main requests and sometimes prohibitions that we have now are about staying out of mines and caves as we enter into the roosting season for bats. And the real reason for this is because of that white nose syndrome. When bats get the fungus, which is white nose, it causes them to stir and to awaken more frequently during the winter. And that puts physiological stress on them at a time when, of course, it's cold, and so it can reduce their survivorship through winter. Any human interruption or disturbance that would happen in the mine and caves at that point can, you know, adds to that level of stress and just makes it more likely that they won't survive winter.
David, you want to follow up real quick?
Yeah, real quick. Besides having the bat house set up, is there anything that can be done to encourage roosting there besides having it there?
Well, so I would say plant a pollinator garden, because then you'd have more insects available for the bats, but that might be counterproductive to why you wanted to have the bat house in the first place.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you want to have pollinators, they're a treat in their own right. So, and you have some nice native wildflowers in your backyard.
You could always try and send up a bat signal, too, just to see.
Yeah. Do you have a bat signal on your bat house, David?
I do. I do have the bat signal on my bat house, as a matter of fact.
Hey, good luck, man. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. My buddy Art writes in. Oh, this is a bear question. You ready? We have a bear that comes around regularly and dumps over our garbage bins, tears apart the garbage, and even absconds with entire garbage bags and runs off with them into the woods and the swamp. We absolutely love bears. Bear emoji. We are wondering if there might be any advice on how to keep the bears out of the garbage and maybe a little bit further away from our house. Bear emoji. We try to wait to take out the garbage until garbage day. We've also tried hiding the bins between the cars, and that worked for a while, but the bear found the bins last week. Our last-ditch effort is to use bungee cords to secure the garbage bins. Anything else we could try to, in a very humane way for the bears, bear emoji, to keep the bears away from our garbage bins and also just a little bit further away from our house, bear emoji?
Sure. Thanks for the question, Art. And it sounds like a frustrating but also kind of comical experience. I'm thinking comical because you put basic rubber bands on the trash can, which is going to make it more fun for the bear.
You think so?
Yeah, that's really not going to do much. It might keep some raccoons out, but the reality is it's pretty clear why the bear's there, right? You want your garbage. You say you're putting the garbage out on the day of pickup, and that's good. I would say don't put it out the night before, because then you're just leaving that salad bowl there for the bear. Wait until the morning of pickup and put it out just before the truck comes, if you can. Alternatively, if there's a way for you to secure the can, and this you're going to have to work out with your garbage collection company, there are bear-resistant garbage cans that you can purchase that the companies will still work with, and bears can't open up. Special latches, magnetic latches, or latches that require a position of your hand that humans can do, but bears can't, that sort of thing. So that's one option. There are some sort of homemade remedy options that might be more effective than bungee cords. Of course, you could use ratchet straps, but bears, if they really want it, they're going to get it.
Yeah.
And even little hasps that you can get at the hardware store, where you can drill acquire the metal hasp and latch it over on either side of the can, and that can be maybe enough deterrent to keep the bear away. But again, making sure that you're not putting the garbage out any sooner than need to before garbage collection is going to be the key there.
All right. Another question about bears. We'll do two more emails and then hit the phones in earnest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Sean Mahar and Jeremy Hurst are here from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Another question about bears from Lisa. I hike in the Hudson Valley, says Lisa, and wondered about bear encounters. The few black bears I've seen moved away from me. Are there any reports of bear aggression? What would be the best way to deal with bear encounters?
Yeah, stay away, first and foremost.
Yeah.
Keep your distance. Don't try and get up close to take a selfie. Don't encourage your friends to come and look at the bear and chase it away. That can actually lead to those negative encounters that we're trying to avoid.
Yeah.
And most of the issues that we've seen so far have been avoidable, especially in instances where we've had bears coming in campgrounds. Many times people are going and getting too close to the bear, which naturally causes them to be more aggressive. So always keep your distance. If you see a bear, appreciate it from a distance and stay away as best as you can.
All right, last question for now, and then we'll go to the phones. This is from Barb in Clifton Park. Pumpkins for wildlife is the subject heading. I've read conflicting information about whether it's good for the wildlife to leave broken pumpkins out. I'd appreciate your insights. And that's from Barb in Clifton Park.
Well, deer and squirrels and a lot of different animals, birds are going to enjoy that pumpkin. And so the seeds inside are going to be great food for a lot of animals. It's not uncommon, actually, for pumpkin farmers to have problems with deer that'll walk through and kick a hole in the pumpkin and chew on it and then walk to the next one and do the same thing. And so pumpkins are a great food source for a lot of wildlife. But I'll tell you what, if you carve out those seeds and roast them, they're great food for us, too.
That's what we do at my house. In fact, they just...
And definitely with pumpkins, too, this time of year. Obviously, when you're done with your jack-o'-lanterns and whatnot, don't throw your pumpkins in the trash. Compost them.
That's
one of the biggest things we can do to help reduce methane emissions in landfills and really make sure that we're composting our waste.
Am I doing okay if we just leave it in the front yard until they dissolve completely?
Sure, Ray.
Is that okay? All right.
For you, Ray, yes.
All right. Well, thank you. And I have a feeling you're being a little condescending. Let's go to Kerry in Plainfield, Massachusetts. You're on with Sean Mahar and Jeremy Hurst.
All right. First, I want to say it's a convenient time for me to have this show. I was going to wait for Rich the Birdman.
Oh, well, but... that's next week, or I think. Yeah.
Well, maybe I can get my answer this week.
Okay.
But anyways, I've been feeding the birds for over 40 years since I live out in this country setting that I live in. And, I get a big variety of them, including the woodpeckers, which are enjoyable to watch. But this is the first time, and I've been feeding them for a couple weeks now, the woodpeckers, and not the downy woodpeckers, it's only the hairy woodpeckers. And they've been banging away, and I have half a dozen outbuildings and my house. And matter of fact, I have some colorful old lobster buoys hanging from the eaves of one of my barns.
Yeah.
And, I collected over a period of time, and they're perching on those things, and they're banging away on those. I can't believe it.
Yeah, wow.
I was just wondering if there's an effective way to take care of them. I know one way. I'm not going to mention it, but you know what
I'm talking
about.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you for that.
I don't know what to do with it, and I don't want to do it the way I'm thinking about it.
All right, fellas, what do you think?
Well, first, thanks for feeding the birds. It is important. Obviously, you got to pay attention, as Jeremy was saying, seasonally, because sometimes leaving that food out can attract bears and other nuisance wildlife that you're trying to avoid. But generally, bird feeding is good. I would say there are some things you can do if you have woodpeckers that are attacking your siding. You can put streamers out on your roof, long, just flowy things that may deter them from going there. If you find them perching on certain things, if you change the way those things are oriented in your yard or put things on it that make it less able for them to perch on, you might be able to reduce that issue that's going on. But Jeremy, anything else you'd add on this?
Yeah, so the birds are probably there for a reason, right? Oh, they're either there for food or because they like the sound. And so it's not uncommon for woodpeckers to be, particularly if you have wood siding, they're finding some insect that might be there. So you may need to consider whether there's some treatment that is necessary to protect your wood. But interestingly, with woodpeckers, they also like loud noises. And so they'll pound as sometimes aluminum siding because of the way the sound carries. And perhaps that buoy that you're talking about has the same thing.
Oh, interesting.
And so what you can do, as Sean said, to deter the birds is one thing, but also to change the density of the material so that it doesn't produce as much sound.
All right, Kerry, thanks a lot for the call. Sean Mahar is the interim commissioner of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Jeremy Hurst is the game management section head for the DEC. Let's go to Schenectady. It's Gary. You're on. Hello.
Yes, good afternoon. This is my very favorite Vox Pop. Thanks for taking my call.
You betcha. Go.
I was hiking a few years ago in the Buck Mountain area. That's next to Lake George. And as I was going up a game trail, I noticed loping down the trail towards me, hadn't seen me yet because I was being quiet and was just standing still at the moment, a large, medium-sized animal, looked the size of a black cat, a long-haired black cat, until it got quite close to me and looked up, and it very obviously had a weasel face. Of course, it was a fisher. So what I'd like to know, what are the status of fishers in the Adirondacks and the Catskills throughout the state? How are they doing? What do you want to tell me about them? And if you have time, I think it's a related animal, a marten. Do we have those in the state? What can you tell me about those? Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the question, Gary. And what a cool experience to get to see a fisher up close. They are amazing animals. I'll answer your second question first about marten. And we do actually have marten in the state. They're more of a boreal species. They're going to be located primarily in the Adirondacks and the northern hardwoods there in the Adirondacks. And so we have marten there, but not elsewhere in the state. Fisher, though, are much more ubiquitous across the state, tend not to overlap with marten in some of the higher peak areas. But we have fisher throughout the Catskills, throughout the Adirondacks, and actually the populations of fisher have been doing quite well. We've seen expansion of the population across the southern part of the state and even into the Finger Lakes and parts north of that. And so we're really pleased. Fisher's doing quite well. We've done a lot of work in the last few years to monitor the population with camera trap studies where we've used baited camera traps to collect hair snares from fishers or hair samples from fishers as well as photos and to better understand the distribution of the species.
Yeah, they are very elusive, so that's a cool find that you were able to see in the wild. I've only seen one once, and it was one of those surprising moments where all of a sudden you're like, wait, what is this thing coming at me?
Well, Gary, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go. Let's stay on the fisher tact here, and we'll go to David in Asheville. You're on. Asheville, I should say. Go ahead.
Hello. Hello there, gents.
Hello.
Great show.
Thank you.
Another question about fishers.
All right.
Once a week, we head up to Bennington, Vermont, near the New York line where a son lives to help with the grandchildren. Last couple times, we've had a great sighting in the backyard of a bobcat. But it was a few days ago, our son called us. He had a remarkable event he witnessed. He looked in the backyard, and there was the bobcat. And the bobcat was in a ferocious fight with two animals, and he's a pretty savvy outdoorsman. He said they were fishers, and the two fishers were in a ferocious fight with the bobcat.
Wow.
Now we online.
Oh no!
Damn, fishers are solitary. What the dickens was going on? Two fishers on a bobcat. Unusual. What are your thoughts,
guys?
Yeah,
that's very interesting. What do you think, Jeremy?
It sounded like two fishers and a bobcat.
I know.
I mean, honestly, I don't know what the scenario was that presented there to create that situation, other than the fact that what a cool observation.
Yeah.
Did your son get video of it?
Unfortunately, he doesn't have a video. That would have been great.
Yeah.
He watched them for quite a bit. The bobcat was getting the worst of the fight. I talked to them and said, are you sure they were fishers? Some other animal might, could it be coyotes or something like that? He had a good look and went outside, and eventually the whole gang of them ran away.
Amazing.
Yeah, so when we saw the
fisher, he thought he...
We had a real quick chat about this idea,
survived.
Wondering whether or not the bobcat or the fisher would win. And so you're saying the fishers were giving the bobcat a run for its money. I would have thought that the bobcat could have fought back a little better.
It was two against one.
Yeah.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah, it could have been a mating pair, too.
Two fishers?
Yeah. Was there any wagering involved with this, David?
Any what?
Any wagering on the battle?
I'm sorry. Say again.
Never mind. Hey, man, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the number. Sean Mahar is here. Jeremy Hurst is here. It's fun, fun, fun going the great outdoors. One more call right now, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll check the email bag. 800-348-2551 or WAMC.org. Well, you probably want to put voxpop at WAMC.org. Still in fund drive mode here. And by the way, thanks to everybody who kicked in during the fund drive. Spectacular showing all. Deborah in Gilboa. Deborah, you're on.
Hi. Hi, Ray and Sean.
Hi.
And
Jeremy.
The guy.
Jeremy. The guy. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I have a question about coyotes. I'm in Southern Sahara County, and I just used to love to hear the sound of the coyotes yapping at night, and, you know, I don't hear them much anymore. And I wonder, is there any evidence of their declining numbers?
So, Deborah, thanks for the question. I'm not aware of any evidence that coyote populations are declining. Coyotes are doing quite well in the state. There is ample prey for the state. However, coyotes have pretty large home ranges. And they're opportunistic feeders. And so when they move around the landscape, if they're finding a concentration of a food resource in one particular valley, they're going to spend more time there. And what we found with some research that we've done on coyotes over the years is that coyotes they actually do pretty well keying in on agricultural areas where livestock growers may have some dead animals that'll provide food sources for coyotes. And so it's possible that there is just a temporary concentration of food somewhere else in the valley that's outside the sound range for you.
But this has been happening for the last, 2-3 years, and my neighbors noticed it too. And I wondered, maybe it has something to do with the uptick in the deer population.
Deer can be a good food source for coyotes. And so
I know.
There are... particular coyotes that become adept at taking fawns, but in the same way, other coyotes have become really adept at taking rabbits or woodchucks.
Okay.
And so I suspect it's just that the family group that had been present nearby you is now moved on somewhere else.
All right, Deborah, we got to take a break here, but thank you for the call. Sean Mahar and Jeremy Hurst from the New York State DEC are with us. We'll be back. We'll check the email bag and then back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Vox Pop, Ray Graff, Sean Mahar, and the guy with you, 800-348-2551. No, it's Jeremy Hurst. That's what his name is. Hey, we'll check a couple emails here, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one is from Michael. I heard that septic field setbacks for state wetlands are changing this year from 100 feet to 300 feet. Any info on this would be helpful, and congratulations on the successful fund drive. Michael, thanks a lot, and I assume if you said that, you kicked in, so thank you as well. All right, guys, the septic field setbacks, you know anything?
Yeah, Michael, we're always continuing to adaptively manage that program based on the water quality impacts we're seeing from septic fields overall, trying to get, obviously, sewering to happen in certain areas to reduce that risk, and others trying to put new technology on septics to reduce their environmental footprint. What I would say is if you have specific questions about that, reach out to DEC's regional office in the area that you're in, and they can help walk you through exactly what the changes are and what you may need to do to comply with the future.
All right, fair enough. This email from Kevin, who says, I understand wanting to curb the prion disease. Did I say that right, prion? Mm-hmm. But aren't there too many deer now in New York and the Northeast? Might the wasting disease be an important curb on populations given the lack of predation? Can the wasting disease infect other animals? And that's from Kevin.
Well, Kevin, you're right to say that there are too many deer in some parts of the Northeast. And the problem is using a disease agent like this to try to manage that is just uncontrollable.
Yeah.
And it would end up impacting populations in areas where we don't have necessarily too many deer. And what a horrible way to deal with deer numbers. So we talk about a terrible way to deal with the wildlife population and make them suffer in that horrible way.
Interesting.
So we look to reduce the likelihood of having our wild deer impacted by chronic wasting disease and seek alternative ways to manage deer populations in ways that can keep the population healthy.
Okay, and you mentioned that deer can be good food for coyotes. There's no indication that chronic wasting disease can go across barriers, different animals.
So chronic wasting disease has not been shown to impact other wildlife species, but I mentioned the disease is insidious. The disease agent, the prion, can pass through the digestive system of a coyote and remain infectious in its scat, which then gets, you know, decomposes into soil and then can be taken up by a plant and then potentially consumed by something else. So that, whether it's a deer peeing or pooping or salivating onto the landscape, that infectious material can get and provide environmental contamination that can then infect other animals at that source location.
Wow.
So that's one of the reasons why this is such a big deal.
All right, this question from Sam in Cornwallville, New York, and then we'll go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Wolf question. My friend in Sharon Springs has heard what he claims is the unmistakable howl of a wolf and less coyotes since then. In any case, have there been confirmed wolf populations in New York yet? And that's from Sam in Cornwallville.
Well, population of one.
Yeah. Okay.
And it was harvested by a hunter in 2021, someone who thought it was a coyote, so he wasn't doing anything inappropriate, but turned out it was awful big, and so we had it tested, and sure enough, the genetics confirmed that it was a wolf. And wolf of origin of the Upper Great Lakes, which is remarkable given the distances. So we have no evidence that there are other wolves in the state now. Certainly, wolf population is even a step further than that. Wolves are capable of long-distance movements, and the closest wolf population that exists to New York is in Algonquin Park and parts of the Laurentians in Quebec. And so there's potential that individual animals could move into the state, but there's no evidence that we
have
a wolf
population. What would prompt them to move that far into the – if they're coming from Canada – just a mistake? Is it not that bright? I mean,
you know, you take a right turn and then a right turn and you go a long distance and you end up in Sharon Springs. So I think really what happens with wildlife is you have young of the year that age into adulthood and they end up leaving the area that they were born. This dispersal happens with most wildlife. And so sometimes those dispersal distances will be 30, 40 miles, sometimes 150 miles, and sometimes you get one animal that just keeps going.
Wow.
And, you know, for the same reason we had a moose one time that ended up in Rochester.
Yeah.
So they just travel long distances sometimes and end up in places that they didn't expect.
Looking for food, too, of course.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to find and chase the prey that they're looking for, and that's where you see it. I think it's important, too, if you think you're seeing a wolf, if you can get a picture of it or a sound of it, please email us at DEC, and we'll keep track of that and investigate that, too.
Your website had a very cool picture, a kind of a misidentification of a mountain lion, I think. And then you proved through science that that was not the case. And I thought that was so cool. It was kind of a forced perspective thing where it looked much bigger than it really was in the on the trail cam or whatever it was. All right, let's go back to our phone lines. It's Sean Mahar, who is interim commissioner of the New York State DEC, and Jeremy Hurst, who is the game management section head for the DEC. And let's see here, we'll go to Del Mar in New York. Seidel, you're on.
Oh, hi. We have an interesting bat situation. We've had a bat that was living between a storm window and our screen now for the past month or so. It will spend the day there. At night it will go away, and then it will come back. And it's been doing that on a regular basis. Recently it sort of disappeared, and I looked at part of the window that was covered by a curtain, and I found it again between the storm window and the screen, but it was up in a corner. And unfortunately, it has not moved from that area for about 3 days. And I just wondered whether somebody had some idea of what was going on.
Okay. They're looking at each other, Seidel, so I don't know.
Well, I would say first keep monitoring it. If it moves again, most likely it is still alive. And when it's out, you can take some steps to potentially seal in the cracks if you don't want it roosting there, and deter it that way.
Yeah, the other thing is, okay, this time of year, the bat, it's probably been capitalizing on some heat from the house, the primary window. And also, it's just been roosting through the summer. So as we get into cooler weather, it's going to be seek its hibernaculum area, and so it's going to leave your space. So Sean's suggestion is good. As it goes out for the night, you know, close up the space so the bat doesn't keep coming back, and it'll find another place
if
to hibernate.
If it's bothering you. Yeah. Otherwise, it's awesome. It's cool. Nature.
Yeah, I hope you
adapting.
Took a picture.
Yeah.
You guys like bats. Hey, thanks for the call, Seidel. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551. We go over to Keene, New Hampshire. And Ed, you're on.
Yay. Hey, thanks, guys. Another bat question.
Yeah, man.
I've got a bat house up. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Good. I've got a bat house up on the side of my barn. It's perfect size, perfect shape, the right dimensions inside, southern exposure, about 15 feet off the ground on the edge of the woods and overlooking a wide field area, lots of pollinators. And it's been up there for 3-4 years, but no bats. What am I doing wrong, or how can I get some bats in there?
Apparently, you need the bat sign.
Yeah,
the bat signal.
Yeah, I think that's that. You guys said that before. I'm going to get that up now. But any ideas? I got a vernal pool nearby. Should I put out another water source for the rest of the year or something? A bird bath, maybe?
Honestly, Ed, I really don't know. We can connect with some of our folks that work with bats more directly to get a better sense of that. I would say, whether it's our agency, DEC, or New Hampshire Fish and Game, you can reach out to one of us probably by email, and we can dig into that a little bit more for you. But this is moving beyond what my
All right, way cool. I'll get the bat sign up,
and
I'll let you guys know how that works.
Thanks, Ed. Appreciate the call. This is an interesting email. I have no idea what it's all about. Mitt writes in, was your agency involved with the Connecticut Division of Fisheries that caught a very large stingray in the Long Island Sound last summer, thought to have a temporary residence in the Connecticut River, like their shark relative, salt and fresh water?
We'll have to check in with our Division of Marine Resources folks. Most things that do happen in the Sound, our teams between Connecticut and New York are collaborating on it. I think what you're seeing, too, is warmer ocean temperatures, food availability coming into the region here is really pushing more species to migrate up the coast, and we're starting to see more and more whales. And it's also a testament to the water quality improvements that we're making. I mean, we're making a lot of great things happen in the environment for the positive, and we're seeing species begin to rebound. So this is a cool finding. We'll have to look into it more.
We're joined today by Sean Mahar, who is interim commissioner of the New York State DEC, and Jeremy Hurst, who is the game management section head for the DEC. Let's go back out to Del Mar. Stephanie, hello, you're on.
Oh, hi. I have a question in regards to opossum.
Okay.
I feed a feral cat, and of course, the cat comes late at night, and I put the food out, and what he doesn't finish, the opossum now has come to finish the food, and also have found the opossum sleeping in the cat's house.
Yikes.
So just recently, I've started bringing in the food at night, and I stopped it from going into the cat's house. I feel bad about that, but I'm just wondering, have I created a monster, and is it going to come through the winter?
Oh.
Well, feeding pets outdoors always runs that risk of, you know, bringing in wildlife that you may not have expected. I wouldn't worry at all about the impact on the possum here. There's ample places for that animal to find some habitation. And so you're doing the right thing by bringing in the feed. That'll work.
All right.
Okay, so do you think that eventually, because I noticed I have a camera, and I noticed last night it showed up. Of course, there was no food out for it. Do you think eventually it'll just get discouraged and stop coming?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if my refrigerator was empty, I'd stop going.
Oh.
Same story, right?
That's how we got Jeremy to stop coming to our house.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it really is. It may not just be the cat food that you've been putting out, but look around to see if you have compost that has been accessible to the possum, if there's any garbage, and your neighbors too. What they do can impact what the possum does.
All right, Stephanie, thanks for the call. I thought they ate grubs and things like that, little bugs.
They will eat a lot of things.
Yeah.
But cat food is an attractant for possums.
And where do they like to live beside cat houses?
Underneath a shed, in a rock hole, in a tree cavity.
We got one under our shed. We see them out in the back. So they're not terribly dangerous?
boy, they make it look dangerous when they smile at you.
Yeah.
They've got some pretty sharp teeth.
Absolutely.
Cool little creatures, Ray.
And last question, and you fellas are way more educated on this stuff than me. Opossum or possum? What do you call it? What's the difference?
I'll let the expert answer that one.
I think it's potato or potato, right? It's however you want to pronounce it.
All right. Well, soon we'll be calling the whole thing off. We only have a few minutes left. Let's go to Wendell, Massachusetts. Rowan, you're on with Sean Mahar and Jeremy Hurst.
Yeah, hey, guys. Really appreciate what you do. Love the show. I had a question about the mountain lion sighting out in Goshen that just happened recently.
Okay, now hang on, Rowan. Goshen, Mass., Goshen, Connecticut, Goshen, New York. What are we talking here?
Correct. Sorry, my bad. Goshen, Massachusetts.
Okay.
I grew up in Ashfield right next to it.
Gotcha. So what do you...
And growing up, we heard tales of sightings all the time. I live in the North Quavon area, and we hear tales of it. I'm one of the people who's always told people, nah, you guys just saw a bobcat. But I heard this one was supposedly confirmed, and just wondering if you guys had heard about it and what you thought.
All right, don't jump at once.
So, Rowan, yeah, this is interesting. I have not heard anything about a mountain lion confirmation in the East recently. You know, the way I've approached this has changed over the years. When I first was in my position as a biologist for the state, at that point, the probability of having a mountain lion, legitimate mountain lion sighting in the East was remote at best. That changed over time as cougars have begun moving further east and are more readily seen in some of the Midwestern states. But really what happened was, I think it was 2011, I don't remember exactly the year, we actually had a mountain lion move from the Dakotas all the way through southern Canada, across upstate New York, was seen near Lake George, was killed by a car in Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
So definitive, right? And there was evidence of that animal all the way along that track. DNA evidence, scat evidence, visual evidence, and so it didn't walk on air. It left tracks, and so when it is not uncommon at all for our staff in New York, and I'm sure the same is true for Massachusetts and Connecticut and all the other states in the Northeast, for folks to report presumed mountain lion sightings. In every other case, other than this one, they have been either, and then this happens very, very infrequently, a released captive animal. Escaped or released. And so that's happened maybe twice. Or a misidentified animal. Coyotes, fisher, bobcat, house cats, dogs, readily misidentified. And so the message just changed because, you know, clearly the experience can happen. These animals can move long distances. It's exceptionally, exceptionally rare.
Okay. Hey, Rowan, thanks. Sean Mahar, you mentioned how, you know, through your efforts, some of these populations are returning to New York. Patrick wrote in, can upstate New York sustain a breeding population of mountain lions?
Well, we'd have to look at food availability, predation. Generally, yes, I think we have some suitable habitat here in the state to support mountain lions. And it's something that we're always actively investigating, as Jeremy just talked about, how these creatures are migrating all throughout the Northeast. You know, it is not unlikely that we will see them in the future.
Why would you want them, though?
Because they're cool.
Well, of course they're cool, but do you want to, you know, is it worth it to repopulate? Get a breeding population of mountain lions.
I think generally anytime you can really work to restore the natural environment here in the state and, you know, really make sure we're supporting the species who were here before we came to be here is important. And it creates a good balanced ecosystem overall and something that we're trying to achieve.
All right. We only have about 45 seconds, but I really want to get to Richard in Steventown. Richard, you have to be super quick. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll make it quick. Two nights this week, I heard a... animal cry at night that I could not identify. The cry started much like a bobcat cry. It sounded like a baby crying, if you will. But then it was followed by a series of, I have to sound it out, woo, 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 woo. It could have been from two different animals, but the sequence was exactly the same the both times.
All right, we're almost out of time.
Any ideas?
Fellas, woo, woo, woo. It's a Curly from the Stooges, right?
Yeah.
No, what do you think?
Boy, I don't
know. That's a tough one.
You've got to get a recording. Sometimes barred owls will bark and they will make that kind of crazy noise.
Ah.
And it could be misidentified, but honestly, without hearing a call, it's
okay.
hard to say.
Well, Jeremy Hurst and Sean Mahar, we're out of time here. Count Basie's playing. Well done, fellas. I got to catch the Sturgeon Thunder episode of the podcast. What's the name of that one again, Sean?
DEC Does What?
DEC Does What? Well, fellas, it was a lot of fun. And, well, you know, come back soon.
Thanks, Ray.
I'm booking next year, so if you're interested, we'll get you guys on again.
Thanks, Ray.
Appreciate it.
All right, so support comes from the Albany Pine Bush Discovery Center, presenting October programs featuring Howl Prowls, Autumn Walks, Watercolor Painting and Photography Workshops, albanypinebush.org. And Broad and Taylor, makers of bread baking tools and equipment for listeners who are interested in beginning their sourdough journey. Recipes, how-to videos, and store at Broad, spelled B-R-O-D, and Taylor.com. Once again, thanks to Jeremy Hurst and Sean Mahar of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, the saintly engineer, and Lightning Eddie Rosen, our screener. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, oh, exciting stuff. It's Stamps und Coins. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.